On today's episode of The Good Word, J.A. Adande joins us to talk about Pat Riley's perfect painful progression and how that applies to the Boston Celtics, the Dallas Mavericks, and the Minnesota Timberwolves. We also talk about the life and legacy of Bill Walton. All that and much more on today's episode.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. It is Tuesday. We did not have a show on Memorial Day because who's working on a holiday when they don't have to? But since it's Tuesday, they're going to make my ass work anyway. And there's no better person to have with me on today, the day of Game 4 of the Western Conference Finals, which could be a sweep, than J.A. Adande. J.A. is the director of sports journalism at Northwestern. You know, the whole Medill mafia that they have over there. He's wearing his purple Northwestern sweatshirt or fleece or whatever that is. Jay, Jay still does stuff on ESPN Around the Horn. What's going on, man?
What's up, man? Good to be here. And we're past Memorial Day. This is when things get real in the NBA. Although, these series about to get real brief.
That's all I was about to say. It's like real over. It's one of those things, Jay, where you go through the excitement of, oh man, you're in the conference finals, it's high stakes basketball, and then like, man, we only got another like 3 weeks of this, and then we got to go into the summer industrial complex of summer league rumors, and then I guess you can
draft, free agency,
the Olympic
all that
games,
stuff.
The draft, yeah. Little stages of grief I feel like we're going to go through because we won't have much to talk about after the finals. But first off, Jay, for those who can't see me, and J.A. can't even see him, but I'll show him this t-shirt I have on. Have on a Stevie Wonder signed, sealed, delivered a t-shirt from a tour that I think he went on like maybe 64, 65. Apple put out, did you see this, J.A.? Apple put out their top 100 albums of all time. Did you see that?
I did, and Songs of Kid Life was in the top 10, right?
It was like number 6.
Yeah, I mean, I really disagreed with Miseducation of Lauryn Hill as number 1. Like, to me, there were 3 that they had in their top 10 that I would have had no problem with number 1. Songs of the Kid Life, or, the Beatles, Abbey Road. There was one other one that, like, if you put those as number 1 of all time, no argument. They did not have What's Going On, Marvin Gaye, in the top 10, which was Criminal. It's hard for me to get upset when I don't even know who voted on this. You know, like, it's,
you know, we don't know the criteria.
Came out. I'm not going to get too worked up over it, but like, Miseducation of Lauryn Hill is the number 1 album of all time. I'm sorry. I just don't see where you get that. Like, again, it could have been Songs of Kid Life, could have been Abbey Road, could have been What's Going On. I wouldn't have any issue with any of those.
Look, Songs in the Kid Life might not even be Stevie Wonder's best album. It could be Inner Visions. Like, at least for me, it could be Inner Visions because it's tighter. You know, it's 9 tracks and there's not a skip among them. Not that Songs in the Key of Life got a whole bunch of skips, but Songs in the Key of Life is just so ginormous. Like, I wish someone smart would do a nice documentary about Songs in the Key of Life. Yeah, but I am thoroughly against. Not that I don't like the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Not that I don't think it's dope, but that ain't number 1. That's not number 1 in this genre. I don't have that album on vinyl, not because like I'm the arbiter of such things, but I can think of like 2 Erykah Badu albums that are better than, you know, that album. I just think that's one of those cult classics that if you're smart, you say, I love the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. And that was my freshman year of high school when that album came out. That album should sit with me. It don't.
Also, another glaring absence from the top 10 is It Takes Nation Million to Hold Us Back, Public Enemy. You know, so on the one hand, you know, if you want to classify Miseducation Lauryn Hill as a hip hop album, it's kind of cool that a hip hop album is number 1, but it's not the number 1 hip hop album. Takes Nation of Millions is the number 1 hip hop album. And has a great case for being in the one album of all time.
See, once again, this is what these lists are made. They're like engagement farms. You know what I mean? These lists are made to get people to argue. It's like you're bringing Facebook to Twitter, and then you're going into $200 dates. Who's paying? And like, I feel like that is the equivalent, the music equivalent of such things. We're not going to do that here, even though we just did it. But
so Jay, Twitter.
What's that?
Oh, well.
No, go ahead.
I know we'll get to this later, but yesterday was actually a great day on Twitter. Monday was a great day on Twitter just because, you know, unfortunately we had to pass in Bill Walton, but it led to some great sharing of stories and videos, just some classic Bill Walton moments. To me, the number one was when he was a guest, guest color commentator, guest analyst on a White Sox broadcast with Jason Benetti, the former White Sox broadcaster who knew him and brought him on. And so, yeah, Bill Walton doing baseball.
Oh, that
and if you think he's off topic doing basketball, Bill Walton, baseball, when there's more time to talk, you know, there's more air time to fill. So Bill Walton in baseball was incredible. That was my favorite Bill Walton memory.
We're going to get to Walton. Now we got to get through this Eastern Conference Finals. And we just got through the Eastern Conference Finals. That was the discussion of the Eastern Conference Finals. No.
There's nothing to get through. They've been gotten.
It's done, right? The Celtics swept the Pacers last night. Another close game. Three out of the four games were really, really close. No Tyrese Halliburton because of the hamstring. Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. Like, I feel like just any greater discussion. This is the Celtics' second chance at the finals. The first time they were there in 22. They were probably the better team against Golden State. They just didn't know how to win. The altitude was too high for them. I feel like we see a little bit of that going on with Minnesota and Denver. We're going to get to that. But J.A., of course, because of your wealth of experience and having covered the NBA for decades, there's a natural progression in how these things go. With the Celtics have experiencing all this pain, you have introduced to me the three Ps. I'm calling it the three
principle,
Ps.
The principle of perfect painful progression.
Oh, four Ps.
You could add another P. You could say Pat's principle of perfect painful progression, because it was Pat Riley who coined the term when he was coaching the New York Knicks. And it's funny because I've referenced it for a while, but I realized I never actually really checked out the source of it. I first heard from Mike Wilbon. I heard him talk about it in the 90s. So I talked about it back then. And then I talked about it in the 2000s. And then I got a little worried because I would Google it recently. And like the only stuff that would show up would be my references to it. I'm like, maybe I kind of made this up. Maybe did he actually say this? So I went back. I used our Northwestern library access to go back and do this newspaper database search. And as it turns out, he first said it right before a lot of these internet archives go back. You know, a lot of the newspapers started migrating to the web in the mid-90s. But in 1994, before that time period, at the start of the Knicks season training camp, as the Knicks were coming off their Game 7 loss to the Houston Rockets in the NBA Finals, that's when Riley talked about that painful progression, the perfect painful progression. And he said they were going to lean into it, you know, and embrace the pain and grow from it and turn that into a championship, as had been the case for so many teams. You know, I'd say most notably would be the Detroit Pistons in the 80s, I think were the – and then – the beatings that they inflicted on the Chicago Bulls and the Bulls having to go through that progression to get their breakthrough moment and win a championship. You know, but it's that notion that you have to advance a stage at a time, a different, you know, deeper into the playoffs, the conference semifinals, the conference finals, the finals, and lose and learn those lessons before you are really ready to win a championship. And that's mostly held true, you know, over the last four decades of NBA basketball.
Yeah, I mean, look, Magic didn't have to go through the losing. Bird didn't have to go through the losing, but Isaiah and
I asked him about that once because we were talking about that, and it was me, Magic, Jackie McMullen, David Aldridge, and Mike Wilbon during the 93 NBA Finals in a room, and Magic was talking about that, how, you know, you have to learn, you have to lose, you have to wait a while. I said, but Magic, you and Bird won, you know, your first couple years in the league. He said, yeah, me and Larry don't count. We're different. So I'm always, that's like the explanation. To, like they're in a separate category. They're different. per Magic Johnson. But for most, yeah, you know, for Isaiah, for Michael, it's funny, the Pistons climb, I didn't really appreciate it being on the other side of it until watching that 30 for 30 Bad Boys. And you, that really gave you the sense for the suffering, for the pain they had to go through. And then, you know, to get all the way to game 7, 88, and then Isaiah's hobbled with his ankle injury, you know, after all that they had been through, you know, it made you realize and it made you really appreciate their championship, you know. And this is from people that hate it. It's funny, when that Bad Boys came out, everyone on social media was like, oh man, I missed those Pistons. I love those. No, you didn't. If you weren't from Detroit, you hated that team. You know, don't get all nostalgic and act like, oh, I love that team. No, you hated them. They would come to your town and beat up your team and play dirty. And so, no, you hated them.
Why are you coming off? No, Jay, I'm going to stop you right there, for one. They didn't just.
Vinny, don't act like those teams were beloved.
No, it's not about Bad Boys. I'm not going to say
they reveled in being the outlaw. They were not beloved around the league, but there was this kind of retroactive love that was being applied to them. You know, everyone, all this notion that 90s basketball, oh, you know, I loved everything about the 80s. And that, like, you didn't love that team at the time when your team was playing against them. But like I said, I came to
appreciate. They didn't just beat people up. Like, this ain't wrestling where you body slam somebody and get 2 points. You know what I mean? Like, they had to actually score and stop you from scoring. And if they fouled you, the fouls were called. So that's what I was railing against, not on the perception of it. I do think the passage of time and the removal of emotion has led them to be more appreciated. And I think that's what you saw, was more of an appreciation for everything that they had been through. And subsequently, like you just said, you gained an extra appreciation for them because your LA emotion was removed from it. I think there was also an appreciation for a general sense of physicality in the way that the game was played relative to the way the game, I think that came out in 2014. So the game was trending more towards the game we see today. It was a year before the Steph Curry 3-point explosion of 2015 and all in the Warriors' first championship. So I just think it was more of a nostalgia for the time of a more different brand of basketball, and those were the guys that ushered it in.
And it was, and maybe still one high day scoring.
We'll, yeah.
You know, like there was some number that, you know, that just recently, one of the games, it was like the highest combined total. And the last time we'd seen that many points was in a Pistons game. It involved those Bad Boy Pistons. I texted you. I was like, damn, the Bad Boy Pistons. But, you know, another thing that those teams did, we think of them as ushering in the era of defensive basketball. And despite the high scores, they were more defensive oriented than we'd seen earlier in the 80s. But it started moving the game away from the low post, right? So the Lakers and the Celtics, you know, were low post oriented, Mikhail in the low post, Parrish, Kareem in the low post. And then with the Pistons, it started to get like around kind of that mid-range game, the free throw line. Like Isaiah took a lot of shots, top of the key, free throw line, Dumars, Vinny Johnson, and Bill Laimbeer, you know, jump shots, you know, mid-range jump shots, you know. And then Jordan operated in the mid-range throughout the 90s. And then, you know, of course, ultimately Steph took it way out beyond the three-point line later in the 2000s. But kind of this removal of low post basketball, this migration away from the hoop, I think started with those Pistons.
That's a great point. And that brings us to even these Celtics, because whenever you look at the spacing on the floor with them, the spacing is set by like movement when you look at Boston, because nobody's just planted down there. Jason Tatum is 6'10". He doesn't plant himself in the post. He doesn't even plant himself in the mid-range.
Al Horford plants does it. Porzingis does it. The tallest guy on their team.
Never. And presumably, he'll be back for game one of the finals. And I think it was probably one of those spots for the Celtics where if the situation was dire, he would have played. But now he's going to have an extra 9 days of rest. He's almost going to have like a month of it. Do you think, or do we think, that according to Pat Riley's, you know, 4 P's of it, does that say that this is the Celtics' year? Not that they have to win, but they should win.
It should, but, you know, the Kyrie factor with the Mavericks, you know, we're presuming that the Mavericks are going to go on and face them, but, you know, A, that Luka has been to the conference finals before, and I think we're seeing that experience pay off for him in this series. Of course, this would be his first trip to the finals. But you've got a guy in Kyrie Irving who'd been there before, a guy who hit arguably the biggest shot in the history of the NBA in that three-pointer that he made to you know, crown Game 7 of the 2016 NBA Finals. So he's got that experience. You know, that incredible stat that he's undefeated in closeout games. I think, is it 14-0 mm-hmm. now, I think? 13-0?
Yeah.
So that's very valuable, and he's showing it, right? He's looking every bit the experienced veteran right now. So with the fact that you've got a guy that's not only been there before, but a guy that's won it before, would that triumph over the Celtics? You know, and then the Celtics, you've got the Drew Holiday factor. So not only do you have a team that's been to the finals, they added a player who has won the finals. And so I was watching the end of game four with the Celtics trying to see, did they look like an experienced team? And they did relative to the Pacers, where in crunch time, the Pacers had turnover after turnover after turnover. And the Celtics shots, it was a mixed bag. I was looking, so it was Tatum created an open three for Derek White that missed. Jaylen Brown got all the way for a great shot that he missed, a layup right at the rim. The one bad shot was Tatum took like a step back or sidestep three, contested three that I thought was not a good shot at that time.
The Kobe system? And then is you that get the Kobe system three? That's what I call it. I call it the Kobe system three.
The drive and the kick out for the open corner three, which, you know, it was a three. I didn't love it, but it was a wide open three. And that wound up being, you know, the main winning basket. Like I get frustrated at teams that take threes in crunch time when you don't need it. All you need is two. You know, the fact that Naz Reid, that three that they took in game two up in Minnesota, like, you're only down one. You know, and there's a wide open three by a guy who had been having an incredible shooting night from three all game. But at that point, why not move closer and give yourself a better chance to make it? Because all you needed was 1 point. You know, the math, you know, the math of three is better than two. Well, sometimes all you need is two. And you know, like the shots that Minnesota was taking were not experienced shots. You could argue that the Dallas hasn't been taking good shots, but they've been making them. You know, and you got two guys who not only experienced but are great at making high degree of difficulty shots in Luka and Kyrie. And that is the Kobe system, right?
That's definitely the Kobe system. I think for Boston is in like a bit of a trick bag, because A, Giannis has been hurt, Dame is hurt. Like, their playoff road has been, like, you look at it and say, oh man, they're 12-2 or whatever it is.
But also, Porzingis has been hurt. Like, we're not talking about that.
Yeah, they're one of their four best players has been hurt. And you're looking at all the stars that have been missing. You're saying, man, they lived a charmed life in these playoffs. Like, maybe things are just setting up for them. They're going to have, or both teams can set up to have up to what, 8 or 9 days of rest, if possible. I think the Celtics are in the trick bag, Jay, because of all those injuries, though. We will judge them by a perfect standard. Like, they can't win by a wide enough margin. If they do, we're going to say, look at who you're playing. You're playing against the Pacers without Tyrese Halliburton. You're playing, you know, who they play in the second round. You're playing Cleveland without Donovan Mitchell. You're playing, you know, this team without this player, like that sort of thing. You're playing Miami without Jimmy Butler. Like, that sort of grading on a sliding scale, where the finals are the only thing that we're going to judge them by and say, this is a pass fail. It ain't A, B, C, D. This is literally either you will win or we will excoriate you. And you are back to being the frauds that everybody thinks you were, as far as regular season record, as far as 2022, as far as what happened last year. Like, I feel like if they don't win this year, and this is probably where they have some relation to the Bad Boy Pistons, in a way that, you know, like the Lakers, in the days in between the finals, Byron Scott hurt his hamstring. And then in the third quarter of game two, Magic Johnson hurt his hamstring. The series was effectively over. But basically, going into that series, it was like, if you guys don't win it now, you're never going to win it. I feel like that's the case for Boston. Even if Dallas comes in on a roll, if you're not going to do it this year, because you've finally gotten through everything in the Eastern Conference, you're never going to do it. And I still might pick Dallas to win the series anyway.
But that stuff is in the moment where we kind of discount things, and then history goes back and really doesn't look at who was injured, who played and who didn't play. You know, we don't talk about, again, we could talk about the Lakers in 88 against a hobbled Isaiah Thomas in game 7 and this and the fourth quarter of game 6, or you know, James Worthy being hurt when the Bulls beat the Lakers the first, you know, we never talk about
the details don't matter.
Yeah. You know, that gets lost to history. So history is not going to record the path that the Celtics took. You know, we crowned the Nuggets champions when, you know, that I think they had the lowest seed path, right? The seeding number of the teams that they faced was among the lowest in NBA history, if not the lowest. So, you know, but we called them the champions and we made them the favorites going into this playoffs, you know, because of that winning that championship. It's funny. The one thing is I feel like I like Dallas better in crunch time.
Yeah.
But yeah, as much as we're criticizing the Celtics as not being able to gain separation and traction against these wounded opponents, the Timberwolves have their full complement of players, pretty much. But Karl Towns is not fully Karl Towns, the greatest shooting big man ever.
What's the percentage? We're going to get to Karl Towns. What's
the 3-point percentage?
I think he's at like 17.
Ouch. You know, so I'm gonna check that number.
Oh no! I overstated it.
It's like Karl 13,
Towns
right?
is shooting 14% from three. 14.6.
They're 13.8 or something. So the fact that the Mavericks have not been able to get separation from the Timberwolves, despite Towns, their second most important offensive player, or maybe third, given the way Naz Reid's been playing, being completely ineffective from three. So are we gonna hold that against the Mavericks? Because we seem to be holding things against the Celtics when we're not holding things against the Mavericks.
No, I think, put it like this. I think that, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but if you are playing such good defense that you are forcing bad misses out of Karl Towns, then that's a credit to your defense. Like, there's nothing that says, at least in my book, that I have to be at my best, you have to be at your best, and let's see if my best beats your best. Like, no, my best may be forcing you to play at your worst. And I think, A, that's part of Dallas's defense is recognizing, you know, I'm seeing it right before my eyes. I'm here in Dallas at this series. And you're watching and you're like, man, Ant-Man is not going through like Jordan rules because it's not as physical of a treatment, but they've got multiple eyes on him. He right. can't
the attention they're giving him.
The attention they're giving him. Like, there's that. And then they're saying—
And the rim protection and the interior defense. Has been
that's, to me, that's the biggest thing. He can't, like, the reason that dunk on Daniel Gafford was so elating, and mind you, J.A., we're not supposed to cheer, and we didn't cheer. But, baby, when that dunk happened, it was one of those things. It almost felt like we were in church and had, like, and caught the Holy Ghost
did
or something
you,
like that. I definitely stood up. I stood up. I did, like, ooh, I did one of those. Like, I'm sitting next to Ben Golliver from the Washington Post. Mark Spears is sitting in front of us. David McMenamin is sitting in front of us. We all did, like, the ugly, stinky face when it happened.
Stephon Marbury?
Yeah. And my
Mark
heart
Stoudemire
stopped. Yeah, but my heart stopped for, like second fluttered. You know what I mean? I felt swept off my feet with that dunk. And I was just like, and it was like, okay, Ant-Man has arrived. And then he went on that run, and then he burnt himself out. And I think part of that, because it didn't look like he had much left in the fourth quarter. And it looked like, Jay, in that series, the one thing that Dallas knows how to do that Minnesota doesn't know how to do, Dallas, or at least Luka and Kyrie, are pacing themselves throughout the course of the game. Kyrie can have a hot quarter. Okay, that means Luka's not going to take over with the high usage. And then Luka will have the great fourth quarter. And, you know, Kyrie will be able to facilitate just movement just by his being, you know, out there, and you have to account for him. That's not the case with Minnesota. That's not the case with Karl Towns. He is so underwhelming right now. Like, I think a bunch of us has been critics of him, and people have said, oh, you're being mean to Karl Towns. This is what you mean when you're looking at Karl Towns. You're looking at all the talent, J.A., and all the gifts, and you're saying, you can score from every point on the floor. You're calling yourself the greatest big man shooter of all time. But when I can't name a big three-pointer that you've made in your career, you're doing this and you're saying you're the greatest big man shooter of all time. And then you're going to Dirk's crib and can't make a shot. I feel like part of that's poetic. But I think.
And you,
go ahead.
I like the line you had as if, you know, Dirk Nowitzki wasn't alive and if he wasn't sitting courtside in these games. You know, like calling yourself the greatest three-point shooter, big man of all time, but also provide a modicum of the interior defense that Gafford and Lively have been providing, and hopefully Lively can get back into the series or get back into get back on the court for the finals. But you know, that again, Dallas's interior defense, and I feel like that's the difference that Dallas can go inside and score. And that option isn't available to Minnesota. And you've got the defensive player of the year in Gobert. And, you know, for as much as he was being roasted for not being able to stop Luka on that three-pointer in game two, like, his job is really to protect the rim, right? That's what he's there for. That's what they traded all those picks for. And he's not doing it, or at least he's not doing that as effectively as Dallas's big men are. And so, you know, and that's looking to the finals matchup. Could that be the difference? Maybe not, because a lot of times the Celtics don't seem that inclined to go to the rim. They seem very content to cast away three-pointers. But you'd like to have that option, and I think they're better when Jaylen Brown is attacking, when Jason Tatum is attacking. But if you make them one-dimensional, if they try a few of those and say, this isn't going that well, then it's another advantage, Dallas, right? So I think I like the shot making in crunch time is looking like Dallas's advantage, and it could be the interior defense is looking at Dallas's advantage. Then it does become a matter, though, of, so Dallas is doing it this level. I think we do have to reserve judgment and see if they can do it at the next level. And that's where that painful progression comes in, where it's funny. So I remember talking about the experience factor going into that classic Lakers-Kings conference finals in 2002, and which still might be the best series I've covered. Just all the twists and turns and the drama, last-second shots. You had two buzzer-beating shots in that series. Everything. Game seven, overtime. Two? Yeah, you had the Robert Horry one, and then you had Bibby made one.
Game five. Yeah.
I mean, to come back from the Horry shot in the next game, was Bibby at the buzzer.
Yeah.
I mean, back to back. And then you had the Tim Donaghy game six.
Yep.
But
yep.
then
yep.
Game seven, overtime, game seven, conference finals. What more could you ask for? A great series. But going into that series, I picked the Lakers. The Kings were the better team. We've been talking about this. Like, you know, the Kings were the better team. They were deeper. The Lakers had the two best players, but the Kings had the depth. They just had more scoring threats. But the Lakers prevailed because of the experience. And something Derek Fisher said going in, he's like, conference finals, semifinals is different from conference finals. You know, it's a different level of intensity, different level of pressure. Same thing. NBA finals is different from finals. You know, I asked Rasheed Wallace once. I had some trepidation asking him the question going into that Game 7 of 2010 Celtics-Lakers in the finals. I said, is there a difference in Game 7 in the finals versus other series? And I was like, he could bark. It's Rasheed, so I thought he might bark at me like, it's Game 7, you know? What do you think? It's the same. But, like, he said no. He said, and I'll never forget, he's like, you know, the pressure in Game 7 is one thing, but in NBA finals, it's like, pachoo! You know, it's like, next level, that you literally said it. And I was like trying to transcribe that. Like, how do you transcribe? How do you write that out?
Yeah. What does it start with a P?
It definitely started with a P. But so it's different, you know? And so the Celtics, their main cast of characters have all been through it. And again, now you had Holiday, who's been through it and won it. And that just might be an X factor, you know? And I want it to be, Vinny. I like the way that these playoffs have played out, where the painful progression has mattered.
Yes, yes,
where
yes.
You feel like the Mavericks are winning this because of how they lost to the Warriors. You feel like the Celtics are just handling the Pacers because, and they put them away because all the times they've been to the conference finals before, while the Pacers haven't, except for Siakam. So this is the way it should be. This is the way it has been. I want it to be this way. You know, maybe I'm guilty of like rooting for the narrative, but like, I think there should be, I'm a believer in an order and structure.
I agree.
This is the order. This is the way, to borrow from the Mandalorian. This is the way in the NBA. This is how it's been passed on. You know, certain things have begat certain things. Legacies here. This is the way. And so I like that order has been restored. And so the natural progression of that would be for the Celtics to win, even though, like, I feel like there are all these reasons why the Mavericks should be fair. I know Boston is the betting favorite, but all these things to me point to advantage Dallas in some critical areas.
It's so weird. And you're right. I think the NBA that we have nostalgic for, the NBA that we long for, like you said, you see the progression. You see that what we're saying is you see the connective tissue from season to season, from team to team. It's a way for fans, even casual fans, to sort of connect. Because NBA casual fans kind of dip in and dip out. You know, it's football season, you kind of dip away. Football season ends, you come back. March Madness, you dip out a little bit. You know, and now it's like you got the in-season tournament. Maybe you dip in there, then you get the play-in and all this other type of things. But as long as you know who you're going to follow because of what happened the year before and what you expect to happen this year, what you're looking forward to, not necessarily the stars, because stars can, that can be sort of fickle. But if you understand by this progression who should be playing each other and what it should look like, or at least the compelling nature of what it could look like, that's how you gain generational fans. That's how you get fans to be able to come back, because you're creating these new stories based off of similar tracks, right?
But Vinny, it's not just the casual fans who don't understand and appreciate that. It's the players. To wit, your exchange with Karl Towns and Anthony Edwards after they knocked off Denver, in which you asked them that normally you have to lose, you know, and they just didn't get it. They thought losing in the first round of playoffs counted. And I would love for you to revisit with them after this series is over and say, now do you see what I was talking about? Like, nothing you had done prepared you for this. And they kind of got to skip a step, right? They were able to knock off the champs, the defending champs, without having played at that level before, right? And that's why you were bringing up how much of an anomaly that was.
What is it about this team that says
we lost last year?
Yeah, but that's different. You have to lose at a bigger stage. Usually, teams.
It's the playoffs. We lost last year.
And they thought that their previous experience of losing in the first round.
We've been losing for 20 years,
right? And the Timberwolves' history of losing, which most of them weren't a part of, you know, right. Like. No, it you had to lose that way. It's funny thinking of the Timberwolves' history. So remember, they had never been out of first round, and then it was their misfortune the first time to in their defense prior to 2003, I think it was, or maybe 2002. They had never had home court advantage in the first round, and then they finally get home court advantage in the first round. And who do they play? The defending champion L.A. Lakers, who had sort of like, you know, futzed around during that season. Yep. And wind up with like a number 5 or number 6 seed or something like that, because they've been, you know, BSing the whole season. But then it was playoff time and they're like, okay, this is what we do. And so poor Minnesota, like, they're all excited. Hey, we got home court advantage. We're going to get out of the first round this time. Like, no, you're playing the Lakers, who had been here before and knew what they were doing. And guess what? They were back home in the first round again, you know, until the now having seen what it was like to play, you know, a real team in the first round and to carry expectations and have to live up to them the next year. Kevin Garnett's MVP season, when they had more experience and they had the guy who was playing better than anyone else in the league that year, you know, then they got to the conference final. But, you know, they had to have a little bit more pain first. And like, so now hopefully, you know, Ant-Man and Cat can recognize that, like, okay, you have to suffer. You have to lose at a high level, I think is the way that you put it. You have to lose deep in the playoffs to be able to progress. Kevin Durant didn't understand it. His first time in the conference finals in 2011. I'll never forget walking out of the arena in Dallas after they lost in game 5 to the Mavericks, their first time getting out of the first round. They get all the way to conference finals. And, you know, and Kevin Durant said, like, man, it was supposed to be our time. You know, like he just couldn't understand what happened. I'm like, Kevin, no, it's not your time yet. You know, you haven't suffered enough yet. Like, You know, you haven't been here before. Like, you weren't supposed to win this. He really thought they were supposed to win. No, you weren't, because it wasn't your time yet. And then what happened the next year, having been through that experience, they get down 2-0 to the Spurs in the conference finals.
Yep.
And they didn't panic, and they went 4 straight, and now they got to the NBA finals, and they won the first game in that series.
Yep.
And then they lost the next 4. Why? Because as some members of the Thunder organization kind of admitted as it went on, they realized, like, okay, the stage is a little bit too big for them. You know, lights like too, they're not quite ready.
Lights
for
are bright. Lights are bright, man.
Yeah, the lights are too bright. You know, like, they weren't quite ready. And they weren't mad at their players, you know, because that's the way it is in the NBA. The Heat had just been there the year before and suffered and lost, and now it was their turn. And so, you know, the problem was the Thunder didn't get to complete the progression because James Harden left, and, you know, they were never quite the same team.
It was weird because the next year I thought they were much better in 13. Like, and then Russell Westbrook and Pat Beverly.
Without,
yeah.
Yeah, and Russ got hurt. And then I think Durant was kind of hurt the next year, right?
Durant was hurt the next year. Durant was hurt.
Yeah.
And
then they got up 3-1 on the Warriors. And, you know, the Warriors with that championship, you know, the Warriors who had been down 2-1 in the conference finals the year before and won, and who had been down, or conference semis,
conference,
I think.
Semifinals.
And they'd been to Memphis, yeah. And they'd been down 2-1 in the NBA finals and won. So they didn't panic being down 3-1 in the conference finals to OKC.
It was so wild. And this conversation is going in so many different directions. I thought, when we think of the Kevin Durant discourse, we kind of discount 13 through 15. 13, that was the Russ injury. They lose to Memphis, I want to say, in 5 games. So it was just KD and nothing else. They lose to Memphis. Mike Conley's Memphis. Grizzlies, that was Conley, Mark Gasol, Zach Randolph, and
Z-Bo.
Tony Allen. Like, yeah, those guys. The next year, in 14, KD got hurt in the playoffs. I can't remember. No, he didn't get hurt in the playoffs, but they lost to the Spurs in the Western Finals. They lost in 6, and that was the year that Tim Duncan. They said, they asked Tim Duncan after the game. I think it was in Oklahoma City. It was Game 6.
Yeah, they interviewed David Aldridge.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, you lost to the Heat last year. You know, da 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 da. And Tim Duncan, very deadpan, said, yeah, we're going to win it this time. And then they went and blew the doors off of the Miami Heat in 5 games. And that, you know what I mean?
And I remember I was like, oh, when Duncan said that, I was like, oh, that's uncharacteristic.
Yes.
You know, it's one of the rare times I think I led my story with, you know, that post-game interview on the court. You know, not something that was said in the actual interview room, because it was so uncharacteristic. But I'm like, you know, if he feels that way, then I believe him. Like, it's not like Tim Duncan to say something like that.
Right.
So
right.
That means it's going to be true.
And exactly. So like you said, all this pain, even for champions who won championships, the Spurs had to go through some more pain before getting back. Because remember, there was a 7-year stretch from the 07 finals to the 14 finals where they didn't win. It was kind of like the New England Patriots when the Patriots went through, I think, maybe 9 or 10 years before winning another championship. They then reeled off another maybe 3 or 4, whatever it was. Like that, even champions go through this sort of pain of losing. Now, before we have to go to Walton, we do have to put a bow on the Indiana Pacers. And I feel like they get a little short thrift, right? Because we look at them and saying, oh, you beat the beat-up Knicks. You beat the beat-up Bucks. But I do think, J.A., with the style that they play, a little playoff pain, and you're getting Ben Mathurin back, like, I do think they could be a team to be reckoned with next year, at least in the regular season. You know what I mean? At least in the regular season. Like, this could be a springboard for them to put themselves as a younger team. Like, Pascal Siakam being a free agent, I would presume that he's going to be back. But Mathurin is going to be 22. Tyrese Halliburton is going to have the Olympic experience, assuming that he's there. Like, do you look at this Pacers team and say, hey, maybe with a few tweaks here or there, maybe you get another shot creator, another shooter in free agency with the cap space that they got, that they could be something next season in the East?
Yeah, and their experience. I mean, if I'm then, I'm walking out of this series. Yeah, we got swept, but we didn't have Halliburton the last couple of games. And, you know, we went toe-to-toe with them. Maybe don't turn the ball over so much during crunch time. And, you know, we could go to the finals. And I feel confident that, like, hey, I feel like we can stand up to a healthy Knicks team. You know, maybe the fluke of that series isn't the injury so much as their otherworldly shooting performance. in game right, seven, right, the best playoff right. shooting field goal percentage of all time. That was timely on their behalf. But again, they have the experience now. That I think they have a better sense of what it takes. They've been through it. Maybe Rick Carlisle needed to be rejuvenated too. You know, the stat was he hadn't won a playoff series since 2011 with the Mavericks when they won the championship. And now he's won two with this group. And he's won two with this style, right? He's completely kind of changed his coaching style and adapted to his team and the modern NBA. And, you know, maybe he has to learn this. Like, this was new to him, too, as experienced right. and as long as he's been around. This was something new for him. And so all that, you know, we have to allow for coaches to improve. Being coaches, we in the verge, would this be the first NBA Finals with two Black head coaches?
Mm.
Joe Mazzulla and Jason Kidd?
Now you're making me go through the archives. I'm trying to think.
I think so. You know, because, I mean, think about it. You can just cross off all those NBA Finals with Pat Riley and Phil right. Jackson and right. Greg Popovich. You yep. know, so you're down to like just a handful of
I mean,
even...
the Finals that Doc Rivers was in, he was against Phil Jackson, right?
Right.
So that doesn't count. It might be. It might be.
I mean, so this could be historic in that regard.
Well, look, Joe Mazzulla is a little more sensitive than Jason Kidd. Jason Kidd will answer your questions. Joe Mazzulla will bark at you. The Indiana Pacers, they're kind of like you guys. It's just hard to decipher what's real and what's not. Dude, calm down. He need to take a Xanax or something, man. Maybe he need an edible before he takes these press conferences because he's a little too wound up, man. Calm down. Good. Have a glass of wine or something. Good grief. He's so damn sensitive.
I feel like edible is a good way for us to transition to Bill Walton. So
there you go. When we come back, y'all, we're going to talk about the life and we're going to celebrate the great and now late Bill Walton. Back here on The Good Word, J.A. Adande. J.A., of course, the legendary Bill Walton passed away yesterday at the age of 71 due to complications from cancer, a long-time battle that he's had. Jay, it's weird because at my age, I only knew Bill Walton as, yes, I knew that he used to play, right? But I knew him as the guy who was sparring with Snapper Jones every week on the NBA on NBC. Like, honestly, I feel like, and you're going to laugh at me for saying this, I feel like that was the first version of sports debate. You know what I mean? Like, Bill would say something crazy, and Snapper would be like, what are you talking about? And it would just be so funny because it wasn't contrived. It was in the course of the game. Snapper would just laugh Bill Walton off. Walton would say, that's not a foul. Let him play. You know, all the things that we would kind of say. But I just feel like Walton is probably the most unique, I guess, figure in NBA history or had the most unique role or was just all around unique. I just feel like,
really,
what sticks
sport,
out to you?
You know, like a guy who at his best is as good as any who ever played his sport, right? Like yes. Bill Walton, which I'm not old enough to have witnessed firsthand. You know, you can put him with anyone. And then to also be as eccentric as like any left-handed pitcher in baseball ever was, right? You know, the flake, we don't have that in sports anymore. Baseball used to have, like, the flake player, you know, some guy who was just wild. But Walton was that, too, you know. And then, you know, probably the world's number one Grateful Dead devotee as well. An avid cyclist, too. You know,
really?
He was, so he had this huge bike. So he would participate. They had this Tour of California that Walton would actually ride the course in the morning before the pros, before the competitors would go out there. He'd ride the whole course. It was like a 700-mile, like, 3-day event that he would participate in that.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. Huge, avid cyclist. So, you know, all these different facets to him, right? And then all this, like, kind of arcane knowledge that he would drop during the Pac-12 broadcast. So the thing about the NBC broadcast, like when he was the, you know, the main guy on the NBC, I think he called 5 NBA Finals, that was the toned down version of him, because I think NBC was like, hey, this is a national broadcast. We're paying a lot of money for this. Like, take it seriously. the fact that it was a three-man booth, there wasn't as much room for him to expound. So, like, what you saw in those national broadcasts was a tone down. He was still doing the Clipper broadcast at that time, and that's when you would see the wilder side of him. And then I think he really started letting loose when he did the Pac-12 broadcast on ESPN. You know, that was full, like, Walden uncut. But the thing that most Americans saw that grew up with the 90s version of Walden was actually a scaled-down Walden. But he still, and also he was a more critical Walden. I think he moved out of that phase in part because when his son, Luke Walden, came in the league in 2003, he had to deal with a lot of backlash, including from his teammate, Shaquille O'Neal, who still remembered what Bill had said about him and what Bill said about guys. So, like, Luke had to kind of take his lumps going around the league because of the stuff that Bill had said. And I think Bill felt a little bad about that. Like, I don't remember him really being critical during the Pac-12. Also, he's calling college. You know, you don't want to be as harsh on the college guys as you are on the pros. But, you know, he could be really critical of guys and didn't hold back. And, you know, they didn't get to play against him, so they would take it out on Luke. Speaking of Luke, I think the one time Bill was, like, short for words or didn't have much to say was when Luke got the Lakers coaching job. And a lot of people wanted to call Bill for comment, and he just wanted to step back and let Luke, you know, have his moment. But he was so proud. He was so proud, and you see him at the games beaming. I've got some pictures. I posted one on Instagram yesterday of Bill with Luke when Luke was in the finals as an assistant coach with the Warriors. And they were chatting on the court. I think Bill was doing some stuff for NBA TV. And Bill just had this huge smile on his face. I have a lot of pictures of Bill on my phone because he was around a lot. You know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar statue unveiling at Staples Center, Bill Walton's there. Jerry Buss Memorial Service, Bill Walton is there. My last picture with him was this year at the All-Star Weekend in Indianapolis at the NBA Legends Brunch, and Bill Walton was there. And so he was around so much. He loved spreading the joy of gospel. I reposted on Twitter an interview he did with GQ, just talking about the joy of Nikola Jokic and how much he enjoyed watching Jokic and just how much better the world was for having Nikola Jokic and the way he played basketball. Like the joy, that's the word I kept thinking of, the joy, the way he lived life. I don't drink that much, and I never, you know, partook in the drugs of choice for Bill Walton. But, you know, I poured myself a drink last night in honor of Bill and raised a toast and just said out loud, you know, to Bill Walton, you know, someone who lived life to the maximum. You know,
yes,
and just wanted to uplift and make people happy and saw the joy and saw the light in everything. I'm old enough. I remember him playing for the Clippers. I remember him playing for the Celtics, six man for the Celtics in 86, one of the best in the single teams ever. You know, that was kind of the renaissance. Like, you know, Walton was the best player in the league in 77 and 78.
In a league with the prime Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah. Like, it was like the best at that point. And you know, can rival Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as the best player in UCLA history, right? Like, he was that good, you know. And I'm gonna, you know, obviously history weighs in favor of Kareem. You know, I can't say who was better at their best, but they were right up there. And there's an argument for Bill Walton. Some people will say he was the best basketball player that they ever saw. And so, you know, and then with the Clippers, he just could never stay healthy, and they never did anything. And then he just kind of put it back together with the Celtics, and him being a sixth man to have, you know, a former MVP come off your bench, what he meant for that team. I mean, that team was, again, one of the all-time great teams. And he was a part of it. And so I it's weird. Like, I can remember him as a player, but I don't have memories of him at his best. So, like, I knew him as a guy, like, oh, man, you should have seen Bill Walton, you know, man, this guy could really play, you know. So I kind of always think of him as that. You know, I'll think of him as a friend, even though, like, we were not that close, but I just think he would think of me as a friend. And so I'll call him a friend, and I'll say I miss my friend. And, you know, basketball will be worse off. You know, it's somewhat poetic justice that he won't have to live in a world that USC and UCLA are in the Big Ten and the Pac-12 no longer exists. You know, that was another time that he almost had nothing to say. Rosh Markazi posted a video of asking him what he thought about UCLA and USC going to the Big Ten, and all he had to say was, "I love UCLA." you know, and he just left it at that because it, I'm sure it just broke his heart that the Conference of Champions was no more.
Jay, there was something that Walton said, and I forgot when he might have said it during one of the Pac-10, Pac-12, whatever it was, when it was still that broadcast. He said, the game is overcoached and undertaught. And I was like, that is like something so profound, yet so simple. Like, it sounds like he's saying the same thing, but he's not. And he's someone who was coached by Jack Ramsey, was coached by John Wooden. You know what I mean? Like, who were more teachers than coaches. Someone who maybe taught you how to think on the fly as opposed to telling you exactly what to do. And I think when we think of today's NBA players as a whole, Jay, we think of them as being, you know, these corporations. Everybody has their own Instagram page or their own, you know, podcast. And we see these very carefully curated presentations of these players being, you know, what people want them to be. And we don't get a chance to see authenticity. I feel like Bill Walton, even when, like, don't get me wrong, Bill Walton said some crazy shit, right? Like, I think he criticized the Fab Five, which I didn't really like because I'm a child of the Fab Five. This was like, you know, 1992 or 93. And I'm like, why are you criticizing these 19-year-old kids? Like, dude, you're sounding insane right now. Like, that's
didn't he call
thing.
Them underachievers?
Yeah, he said something like that.
He said like they were underachievers as they were on their way to, like, and somebody asked, I think Jalen about that. They asked the whole Fab Five at the press conference in 93. They're like, it's like, I hope I keep underachieving like this the rest of my life. You know, like back-to-back championship. I'll never forget, Chris Webber walks out at a press conference and he had his little camcorder and he was filming in the Hyatt in New Orleans. They had all these big pictures of like past Final Fours and, you know, most outstanding players of the Final Four. And there's a big picture of Bill Walton and Weber's filming. And he goes, yeah, where you at now? You know, that was his little narration to it. So again, there were a lot of people that were mad at him, and the people that played long enough to play against his son, took it out on Luke. So yeah, but that was part of his being, you know, authentic, as you said, and speaking his mind and, you know, not, kind of living with his truth and living within his truth. Something else that he said that was kind of profound, and he meant it as a joke, but it had a deeper meaning to it. So when he was doing that White Sox broadcast I talked about earlier, and Jason Benetti, I think, asked him if he'd ever played catcher, and Walton says, like, you know, I was never a catcher. He goes, I was better at getting high than getting low.
Oh.
And, you know, so it's a great line. And he's talking about it just in terms of, you know, like he didn't want to crouch down low like a catcher.
Right, right, right.
You know, and you could.
He knew what he was saying.
What he meant by high. But I also feel like he never got low as a person. He not in public. So he talked later about how he had some suicidal thoughts when he was dealing with this debilitating back pain that just had him living in constant agony. And the pain was so unbearable that he questioned whether or not he wanted to go on living. And he got through that. But, and I know some of that had to linger, and it's quite possible the last time I saw him in February, he was dealing with cancer diagnosis, right? And yet I never saw him low. To him, to once he could be outside and, you know, just be out walking around and afraid, like whatever it was, he was going to be high off that. In addition to maybe being high off other things, you know, but literally he was high on life, and he refused to be low around other people because he didn't want them to be low. Right. And so, again, I'm sure he suffered privately, but he never suffered publicly. And just a little thing I noticed in my pictures with him. So he was sitting on the stage. And we went up and we talked to him, and I'm like, Bill, man, I want to get a picture. I was taking pictures of that when I just gotten the great news that I'd been, you know, named the Kurt Gowdy Award winner. And so I was just taking pictures of them, especially Hall of Famers. And so I was like, Bill, let's take a picture. And so he was sitting down. So we took a quick selfie together. And then, he was like, no, that's not good enough. Let's stand up, you know? And so he stood up, and it might've been painful for him to do that, but for him, let's do this, you know, let's do this right. You know, let's live life properly, you know, and let's live life to the fullest. And if we're going to live life to the fullest, we're going to stand up and take this picture. Even if that might've been painful for him to do, even if he might've been low in energy, he was never low publicly. And I just, man, we're going to miss, like, the world is a worse place. Like, I can't believe we never get to see him again, hear from him again. You know, he just made life so interesting. You looked at the cross section of people that were paying tribute to him, everyone from Dr. J, who, you know, lost to him in the NBA Finals, to members of the Grateful Dead, to all the broadcasting partners. He, like, this wide swath of people that were all Bill Walton fans, you could say.
It's really hard to put his career, basketball career, in words, because of the injuries, where the highs were so high and the lows left you like, man, you don't know if he's going to get back. And then the Celtics thing happened, where it was one shining year. You know what I mean? It was one year with the Celtics where he was sixth man, Bird, McHale,
Parrish.
It was beautiful basketball. All that. It was just one shining year. And when you think of, like, the what ifs in terms of, Twitter, Instagram, they always put up these, you know, who would you have wished to be perfectly healthy for his entire career? And he says, well, Derrick Rose or Brandon Roy, who I think was really good, but I don't think he's in that class, you know, or Grant Hill and Penny Hardaway are the main ones. And then then people don't think of Walton in the same way, in part because you got to see him at his apex. You just didn't get to see him do it long enough to reinforce his greatness. And I think he carried that on without bitterness. Like, the fact that he wasn't bitter about his career and was able to talk about the game with joy. Yeah, he talked about the game with joy. And man, it is, I'll tell you this, it's really hard to be upbeat all the time. If you have friends who are really, really upbeat, chances are they are battling something that you don't see a lot of times privately. Like, they're doing a lot to keep themselves up. They're doing a lot to keep themselves going. They're doing a lot to make sure that they are a light for you and a light for the world. So for Bill Walton to have continuously been a light for the world during times where he was battling cancer, where he was battling back pain, where he was battling knee and foot and all that type of stuff, that took a lot of energy. But I think you're able to see, or we're able to see, the fruits of that light that he gave to the world and to all those people with a lot of those tributes yesterday. And I am shocked, y'all, that nobody on YouTube, if all the damn videos we got on YouTube, the billions of nonsense we got on YouTube, nobody's put together a Bill Walton and Snapper Jones supercut. Like, seriously, y'all, we don't have a supercut.
Oh, man.
Give me 10 minutes of Jones and Walton just snapping at each other. Like, if someone does that, I will pay you, okay? And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this year's winner of the Kurt Gowdy Award, J.A. Adande. J.A., when you get inducted into the Hall of Fame, I will be there in support because, you know, you're my guy and I appreciate you and all that. And today's episode was so full, we didn't even get a chance to talk about how do we talk about Kyrie Irving in the future? How do we talk about Kyrie Irving potentially going back to Boston for the NBA Finals? Maybe I'll bring J.A. on next week to talk about that. Like,
I'm kind of glad we didn't get to that. I'm not ready for that discussion. I'm not ready for that discussion.
Look, man, there's a bunch of Boston jokes that I have that a few of my, fairer friends, shall we say, they find absolutely hilarious. But they're like, am I allowed to laugh at that? Yes, you're allowed to laugh at that if I'm the person telling the joke. That, ladies and gentlemen, is J.A. Adande. Don't forget, guys, Thursday we get No Cap Room. Friday, we have On the Clock with Kristen Peek. You'll see me Monday. The NBA Finals will start on Thursday on the 6th. I'm sure we will have plenty to talk about on next Monday. Maybe it will be Kyrie Irving and the Boston Celtics. Thanks to producer Joe stepping in for producer John this week, who's away, and everybody who works hard behind the scenes on this show. Until next Monday, everybody be safe.